last time I was talking about the First World War and the main factors that govern the outcome of the war. And I guess one of the key points there was that the really crucial event was the intervention of the United States in the war. America is already by far the strongest power in the world in terms of mobilizable war potential. Not forces in being, because of the mere fact that America is so strong and so incredibly secure. You know, great oceans to the east and west, weak neighbors to the north and south, meant that the United States didn't have to divert a large share of its national income into maintaining a large military force, even a large navy. All right. But when the United States came in, fresh power, not exhausted by years of this, you know, debilitating struggle, it's enormous bloodletting in the First World War, the American intervention proved to be decisive, more important even than the withdrawal of Russia from the war following the Bolshevik Revolution toward the end of 1917. American intervention, April 1917, the Americans are determined to fight the war to the end, to achieve a victory over Germany, to crush Germany. And they achieve that goal. And the withdrawal of Russia from the war meant that this victory would be achieved by the three great Western democracies, Britain, France, and the United States, and by them alone. Unlike World War II, where the victory was achieved in conjunction, this time with communist Russia. 1918, November 1918, Germany gives up. It's not an unconditional surrender. This is an important point, by the way. It's very different from 1945 when Germany was invaded and Germany was forced to accept surrender unconditionally. In 1918, Germany was not invaded. The Allied armies were still in France. German soil had not been touched by the war in any serious way. And the Germans surrendered only after they had reached an agreement with the Allies called the Pre-Armistice Agreement, basically laying out the conditions on which the peace would be made. And the Allies committed themselves. One of the sources of instability in the post-World War I period, and one of the reasons also for the adoption of the unconditional surrender policy during World War II, is that the Germans argued, and they had some legitimate basis for this argument, that they were cheated. They laid down their arms not unconditionally, but only after certain promises had been made, namely that the peace would essentially be based on President Wilson's program as laid out in his famous 14-point speech, which you read, and in his other wartime addresses, with only a couple of exceptions. One related to freedom of the seas, the issue that the United States supposedly had gone to war over in 1917. Basically, that was withdrawn because, you see, freedom of the seas, if you take it seriously, means that a navy has no function. If everybody agrees to be abide by the principle of freedom of the seas, that means anyone can trade with anyone else. And you can't use blockade. You can't, freedom of the seas meant that the British also couldn't have blockaded Germany. Right? In which case, what's the function of British naval power? And yet the British Navy was a central instrument of British power. And so, freedom of the seas, you couldn't take that principle too literally. So it was dropped from the pre-armistice agreement. And the other thing was it was made clear to the Germans that those provisions in the 14 points that called for the restoration of the devastated areas meant that Germany would have to pay compensation to her former enemies for the damages caused by, in the phrase of the agreement itself, caused by the aggression of Germany by land, sea, and air, right? But with those two provisos, the Germans agreed to lay down their arms, and the Allies promised that the peace would be based on Wilson's speeches. All right. So, but effectively, the Allies had won the war. The three great Western democracies had forced the Germans to lay down their arms. Germany was put in a position where she couldn't continue the fighting. She couldn't resist the Allies, and the Allies had within their power to simply impose peace terms on Germany, to dictate the terms of peace to Germany. This was not a negotiated peace. This was not a compromise peace. This was not the sort of peace that Wilson had called for prior to American intervention in the war in the Peace Without Victory speech of January of 1917. Okay. So this peace, the peace of 1919, the peace laid out in the Treaty of Versailles, right? The peace that was the product of the negotiations at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919. They went out to a suburb of Paris called Versailles to kind of actually sign it. So it's called the Treaty of Versailles, the Versailles Peace of 1919. This peace was dictated by the three great Western democracies and by themselves alone. It was the only major peace settlement in modern history to be dictated solely by the Western democracies. It also proved to be the most unstable peace settlement in the entire history of great power politics. Right? And one of your jobs is to figure out whether there's any connection between those two things. Is it an accident that the one peace settlement that was dictated by the democracies turned out to be the most unstable peace settlement? Because we'll see just like 10 years later, the whole thing is in a shambles. 20 years later, this new and more dangerous war with Germany breaks out. The Versailles peace was clearly a failure. Why was it a failure? Right? Did the basic problems have to do with the fact that it reflected the political philosophy of the democracies, or was it a failure in spite of that fact? Right. You see what we're doing here? We're using this whole historical problem as a vehicle for getting at one of the basic issues in the interpretation of international politics. There's this view that you absorb from the general culture. What is the view? Say, how should foreign policy should be conducted? According to liberal principles. We should promote democracy abroad. We should promote liberal institutions abroad. Right? We should base our foreign policy not on considerations of power, but on some sense of what's just, what's proper, what's in line with, you know, basic human rights, basic moral principles, right? To conduct a foreign policy that ignores those sorts of things, an amoral foreign policy, a policy that emphasizes political interest, power, political considerations. That's not just bad, it's un-American. You know, that Wilson firmly believed that that was the source of the problem, right? A policy based on power political considerations was not the solution to the whole question of how foreign policy should be conducted. That view was what created these difficulties that led to wars in the first place. Right? That's the liberal view. It's the natural view that people have. You know, what's the right policy? It's a policy based on the pursuit of right, the pursuit of justice, and so on. That's a normal, natural way of thinking these things and about these things, and it's also the way that of thinking about these things that you absorb from the general culture, the liberal view. Okay? But as you all know, there's a whole school of thought that not only takes issue with that basic set of assumptions, but derives its power from the fact that it does take issue with them. It derives its power from the fact that it's counterintuitive in terms of its basic thrust. This is the realist view. the realist view, and you saw it laid out by George Kennan in that article that you read about American intervention in the First World War. It was just an extraordinary article. I mean, for me personally, this was like almost like the blinders falling off my eyes when I read that article when I was your age. And it's like there's this wholly different way of looking at these things. All the stuff that we were taught was the right way to go, you know, pursuit of justice, peace based on moral principle, and so on. That, it turned out that was a huge source of instability. And Kennan kind of lays out in all kinds of ways why it was so problematic. You know, it's like the path to hell really was paved by good intentions. You know, Wilson really did pave the way for Hitler, right? Not simply because Hitler was able to exploit the whole Wilsonian principle of self-determination to achieve some of his successes, but in a much more profound way. You have to think in terms of power. You can't let yourself be carried away by all this moralistic stuff, because if you do, you're going to pursue the wrong sorts of policies. They're going to be policies based on moral principles that we're right, they're wrong, they should be punished, they should be crushed because they've committed a crime. This is just an enormous source of instability in international politics. The proof? Post-1919. The whole story of the interwar period, according to the realists. So that's the basic problem in the interpretation of international politics. Who's right? The liberals or the realists? You know, Wilson or Kennan? How do you get at that problem? Right? If you just wanted to get a handle on it, what would you do? How would you approach it? How would you go about figuring out who's right? Are the realists right? Okay? And the fundamental premise of this course in methodological terms is that there's one and only one way to get at it. And that's by examining these issues in concrete historical context. You know, when these issues are argued out at this very abstract general level, you know, it's like grasping at a cloud. You can't really get very far. There's no closure. There's no way of figuring out which is right and wrong. So you have to kind of bring it down a level of abstraction. You know, show how these very general views about how foreign policy should be conducted and what makes for a stable international system and so on translate into and have certain affinities with, resonances with, specific historical interpretations. Okay? And in this case, they're connected with historical interpretations of what happened at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 and how the Treaty of Versailles is to be understood. Because liberals say, Wilson wanted all the right things, but he couldn't achieve his goals because he had to deal also with the British and the French. And whereas those countries were democracies in terms of their internal institutions, they were also great imperial powers. So they were only kind of half committed to the Wilson approach. And they still bought into these antiquated notions about the balance of power and the importance of security and so on. And so Wilson couldn't simply impose his own views. He had to compromise. Right, and those compromises proved fatal. Those compromises were the reason why the Treaty of Versailles was as bad as it was, why it was as unstable as it was. Right. The realist view is very different. You saw in Kennan. It's like the realist view is all these problems with the Treaty of Versailles, they weren't in spite of Wilson's efforts. They were a direct result of the sort of policy that Wilson pursued. Okay? Who's right? How do you figure out who's right? What we're going to do is break that problem down into two parts. The lecture today is going to be devoted to the question of at the general level, in terms of the basic thrust of each of these countries' policies, the U.S. policy, British policy, French policy. At the general level, is that how the peace conference is to be understood? Are the liberals essentially correct? Is the basic set of principles that lay at the heart of the Versailles Peace, are they in line with Wilson's principles, or do they contradict Wilson's principles? Did Wilson try for something different, or was this kind of peace the sort of peace that he felt comfortable with in 1919? Okay? So that's what we're going to do today. And next time, we're going to shift the focus and look at the peace settlement in greater detail. Look at it issue by issue and say, are these different provisions to be understood as the product of a struggle between the Americans, who wanted a relatively moderate peace, a peace of reconciliation with Germany, and the French, who were much more hard-boiled and wanted a much harsher peace settlement in order to provide for their own security. They felt that they had to weaken Germany. Is that the case? And also the final terms of the peace, are they in line with what Wilson wanted, or do they represent a defeat of Wilson? So that's going to be next time. Today we're going to limit ourselves to the general stuff. Okay? What was the Wilson Peace Program? In the Peace Without Victory speech, January 1917, before the United States declared war on Germany in April 1917, 3 months before, Wilson had laid out a very moderate program. You say, peace without victory, peace among equals, a negotiated peace, a compromise peace. If you go the other route, it'll lead to all sorts of problems. And I read you some of the key passages from that speech last time, right? Before the United States goes into the war. After the United States goes into the war, it's like a great switch gets thrown. Compromise peace? Inconceivable. Germany has to be crushed. Germany is evil. Germany had committed a great crime. Anyone who says differently is unpatriotic, un-American. That's the Wilson line in late 1917. You saw it in that speech of December 1917, which I hope you were shocked by, given what you were told about Wilson in high school. Because the view that a country has of its own past is not necessarily historically accurate. You know, it comes into being because it serves political purposes in larger culture. Yeah. Right? How is that new Wilson policy to be understood? Well, it's rooted in the same moralistic perspective that lies at the heart of all of Wilson's thinking. Right? When we were out of the war, we could afford to be impartial. You know? We're better than the Europeans. The Europeans have this problem of always struggling for power, and they're kind of caught in that whole, you know, game of the balance of power. You know, thank God we don't have to, you know, play that sort of game. You know, that's why we could be better than the Europeans. You know, America never thinks of itself under Wilson as part, or even today for that matter, as part and parcel of the normal system of power politics. America's not inside that system, but rather outside it. And to the extent that it's involved with it at all, it's like looking down on it. You know, saying, well, you people, we know the way to go. We'll hold up a vision of a much better world for you. We'll give you precepts and so on. Right? These moral considerations are absolutely fundamental. If we were forced to enter the war, and we're good by definition, that means necessarily that the other side has to be viewed as evil. You know, realists don't look at things that way. They say, well, we went to war because we had interests. Other countries have interests. Ours aren't inherently more legitimate than theirs. It's normal, it's a natural feature of the system that there are going to be these political conflicts. You shouldn't make too much of it. You shouldn't talk about your adversaries as evil. That's the realist perspective, very jaded. The Wilson perspective, the liberal perspective is, if we're forced to go to war, then the other side had committed a crime. A war is a crime. And if a war is a crime, then the criminal power should be punished. And I should say, not just Germany's leaders, but also the German people. They should be punished. They should be forced to make amends for their crime. They shouldn't be accepted as a full member of the international community right away. They should be subjected, as in a very typical Wilson phrase in the spirit, to a generation of thoughtfulness, he said, in which Germany would not have the same political rights as everyone else. Germany's sovereignty would be limited in a way that the sovereignty of other countries would not be limited. And I should say that this attitude persisted well past the Second World War, to the point where even the unified Germany today doesn't have the same political rights as other countries. The unified Germany today is not allowed to build nuclear weapons of its own. And without a nuclear capability, it can't be truly independent politically. Okay. So you have this Wilson approach. Germany is a criminal country. What should the peace be based on? Balance of power? Right? No, that's the problem. People in the past had tried to do that. That's what created all this instability in Europe in the 19th century. We want to base the peace on moral principles. The fundamental idea is justice. What's just? What's right? What's proper? Justice is the central notion. All right? But think of what justice means. Justice means that if countries commit crimes, they have to be punished for their crimes. Justice implies a punitive policy. Germany has to be brought to justice. Among other things, they committed the crime of invading Belgium, even though Belgium's neutrality had been guaranteed by the powers, including Germany itself. Right? These are crimes. You got to punish them for that. They call the crime of causing the war. And you see, Wilson just took it for granted that Germany was uniquely to blame for the war, that the war was a war of German aggression. Okay? This is, before any documents had been released, before people had the chance to kind of study the issue in a really serious way. I should say another thing about Wilson. Does anyone know what Wilson? Wilson was the only president of the United States who had a PhD ever. Do you know what field his PhD was in? Anyone? Political science, right? Again, makes you wonder, right? Germany should be punished. What's the proof of this? You look at the records of the peace conference, and Wilson says this stuff over and over again. And then after the peace conference is over, he goes on this. He comes back to the United States, and he has to get the Senate to ratify the treaty, which included the Covenant of the League of Nations, was part and parcel of the treaty. And this is, Wilson's great dream that an international organization would kind of solve all these problems. But there was a certain degree of reticence on the part of the country to going into the League, because the League called for an absolute guarantee of the territorial integrity of every member state. So people saying, does that mean we're going to have to go to war in the event of these little border clashes in these remote parts of the world? So Wilson had to make the case to the American people. He went on this big tour of the country making all of these speeches in which he laid out his basic thinking about the peace. So I'm going to just read you some of this stuff because it just... so much at variance with what you'd been led to believe about Wilson as the great champion of a moderate peace, a peace of reconciliation, and how he's frustrated by these kind of clever Europeans and so on. Okay? At the end of the peace conference, the British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, he got second thoughts about the treaty and tried to soften it in certain ways. And Wilson resisted those attempts. He told Lord George, he says, he's not willing to change anything in the treaty because it was severe. That he wanted this to be a historic lesson so that people might know that they could not do anything of the sort the Germans attempted without suffering the severest kind of punishment. Right? A little bit before that, he responded to another appeal from a South African statesman for a major softening of the treaty. He wrote back, the treaty is undoubtedly very severe indeed. I have, of course, had an opportunity to go over each part of it as it was adopted, and I must say that though in many respects harsh, I do not think that it is on the whole unjust in the circumstances, much as I should have liked to have certain features altered. I feel a terrible responsibility of the whole business, but inevitably my thought goes back to the very great offense against civilization which the German state committed and the necessity for making it evident once and for all that such things can lead only to the most severe punishment. Well, that's what he's saying in private, okay? Germans have committed this crime, they got to be punished for it. If they're not punished for it, it just makes a sham of your belief in the importance of justice. And then he makes the argument in public on this big speaking tour he makes in the second half of 1919 after he gets back to America. This is September 4th, 1919. He says in a speech, the treaty seeks to punish one of the greatest wrongs ever done in history, the wrong which Germany sought to do to the world and to civilization, and there ought to be no weak purpose with regard to the punishment. She attempted an intolerable thing, and she must be made to pay for the attempt. Okay? No talk about reconciliation here. No talk about peace without victory and the importance of moderation and reintegrating Germany into the community of civilized nations. None of that stuff. Then an Omaha speech, September 18, 1919. I hear that this treaty is very hard on Germany. When an individual has committed a criminal act, the punishment is hard, but the punishment is not unjust. The nation, meaning Germany, permitted itself through unscrupulous governors to commit a criminal act against mankind, and it is to undergo the punishment. All right? All right? Wilson's basic moralism went hand in hand with a belief in the importance of a punitive policy. Okay? Very, you know, it's the core of Wilson's thinking at this point. It's right to punish the Germans. It's not like, well, I have no choice. I had a compromise with the British and the French. I would have preferred a much softer peace, but I had to, accommodate to those political realities. Right? So if that's the basic Wilson approach, the Treaty of Versailles, which is based on the idea that Germany was not to have the same political rights as the victor powers, was very much in line with that approach. The Treaty of Versailles is a set of constraints limiting German power, keeping Germany from again opposing a threat. And we'll talk about what those constraints are next time. Germany's armaments were limited in a way that the armaments of the victor powers were not to be limited. What's the justification for that? The justification is Germany is a criminal nation. Germany has to be kept down because of the crimes that she had committed. Okay? Very much in line with the basic Wilson philosophy. Okay. Important conclusion relating to this whole issue of liberalism versus realism that I was talking about. If you believe that the punitive aspects of the Treaty of Versailles were a source of instability, and those punitive aspects are very intimately tied to the basic Wilson philosophy, well, then that tells you something about what to make of the basic Wilson liberal approach, right? Important point for our purpose. What about the two other powers, right? It's not just Wilson who dictates the peace. The peace is a product of a negotiation, not between the West, between the Western democracies and Germany, but among the three Western powers themselves. Begin with the British policy. British Prime Minister Lloyd George, he's on the left of the British political spectrum. Before the war, he was kind of on the left of the Liberal Party. I mean, but then during the war, he defected from the Liberal Party with a group of his followers and went into a coalition with the Conservatives. The Conservatives are leery of opting for a punitive peace. You know, one of the conservative leaders, Austen Chamberlain, he said, well, you know, a policy of vengeance is, you know, he says, it's too expensive nowadays. Okay. This was in the War Cabinet, as the armistice was approaching. And the Germans wanted to end the war before German territory was actually invaded. And Lloyd George said, I don't think we should agree to that. Right? We should invade Germany. We should go on, in his phrase, go on lashing Germany as she has lashed France. And then Chamberlain, this is the brother of Neville Chamberlain, who we're going to talk about when we deal with the 1930s. This is Austen Chamberlain, key leader of the Conservative Party, the leading party in the coalition there. Chamberlain said that vengeance was too expensive these days. The Prime Minister said it was not vengeance, but justice. Same Wilson policy, associated with the left. The interesting thing is that the further to the left you go, the more vindictive these statements are. The British held this election right after the war was over, 1918. And there was this, you know, huge fury unleashed against Germany. The people whipping up were people furthest to the left. The one member of the Labour Party, the guy named Barnes, who was part of the British War Cabinet, he was the one who called for hanging the Kaiser. The Conservatives tended to say, well, the Kaiser should be tried. But there is this kind of a vindictive spirit that you associate with the left, because the left, as opposed to the right, tends to think in more moralistic terms. And Lord George himself gave a speech just 2 days before the armistice. The armistice, is, as you all know, is the 11th hour of the 11th month, or the 11th hour, the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918, November 11th, 1918. This speech was given in London on November 9th, 1918. And Lodge says, we cannot forget the reckless wantonness with which the rulers of Germany, with the full assent of her people, committed this atrocious crime against humanity. They cheered their rulers for the deed. They would have cheered them today had they won. We must keep that in mind when we seek security. There must be terms which must discourage ambition and arrogance from repeating this atrocity against humanity. Justice, divine justice, the foundation of civilization. Justice must be satisfied. The country that recklessly plunged the world into that agony must expect a stern reckoning. Right? You want to punish these people. No thought about what should be the fundamental purpose of peacemaking. How do you make for a more stable international system? How do you make for a peaceful world? This sort of view, punish the Germans for the crimes they had committed, this was a view that looked to the past. The realist view, on the other hand, is one that looked to the future. Because the notion, the basic notion that lies at the heart of realism, is that power plays the fundamental role in international political life. You cannot ignore power considerations when you're thinking about these problems of foreign policy. Okay? But if power is of such fundamental importance, we have to think in power political terms. We have to think about how to create a stable structure of power, a stable balance of power. We shouldn't think in moral terms. We should think in political terms, right? That's the in amoral terms. That's the view you associate with people like Kennan, for example. And in fact, it's a view you associate with conservative critics of the liberal tradition from the early 19th century to the present. Okay. The Americans, the British aren't thinking in those terms. Who was thinking in those terms? Well, there was one statesman at Paris who did represent the realist tradition. And this was the French Prime Minister, Georges Clemenceau. Right. I should say one thing. Why is the difference between France and the Anglo-Saxons? Is it a question of political culture? Are the French less democratic than the British or the Americans? Not so. The United States in this period is not a full democracy, by the way. Throughout the South, black people are essentially disenfranchised. Wilson was... He was a racist through and through. If you want to be shocked, you should read some of Wilson's comments that he made when he was a professor, by the way, about the race issue. It's quite extraordinary. France was like a more advanced democracy than the United States in many ways during this period. What's the difference between France and America? The difference has to do primarily with their geopolitical situations. Here's the United States, so phenomenally secure. I mean, the United States produces as much steel as all of Europe put together, pretty much, right? And steel production is the key measure of potential military power given the technology of that period. And it's not just that, America's geographical position. You know, this is a country that occupies essentially a whole continent. And, you know, and as I say, protected by these vast oceans and, you know, with no serious rivals in the hemisphere. Okay? And you compare that with the position of France, stuck there, right on the continent of Europe, the country that's inherently the most powerful country in Europe, Germany, as France's immediate neighbor and longtime rival. Right? France is a lot weaker than Germany. You know, 40 million Frenchmen versus 60 million Germans. And then if you look at the economic measures of military potential, the gap is greater still. That's the basic problem for France. A country like the United States that's so incredibly secure and powerful can afford to indulge itself in the luxury of ignoring geopolitical principles, geopolitical realities. It can afford to indulge itself in thinking in ideological terms. This is what you would expect of an extremely strong country whose power is not balanced. And I should say this is true of American policy throughout the 20th and into the 21st century. You know, last year I remember reading a speech that Vice President Biden gave, actually a couple of speeches he gave when he went to these former Soviet republics, Ukraine and Georgia, just showering them with American security guarantees. So, you know, someone like me thinks, this doesn't make geopolitical sense at all. What are we going to do when Russian power revives? We're going to be stuck with these commitments? And yet, you know, like no one talks about this stuff. But it's not that the liberal tradition for internal reasons is particularly strong in America. It was able to flourish because of our geopolitical situation. France is too weak to ignore power political realities. It can't afford to indulge itself in that sort of thing the way the Americans can. All right, they have to think in power political terms. And here's Clemenceau. He's on the left of the French political spectrum, but he thinks very clearly in geopolitical terms. And I'll talk about this in a minute. What about Britain? Well, the interesting thing about Britain throughout this period is that Britain's not quite in Europe, but it's close enough to Europe that it has to worry about what goes on the continent. If all of Europe comes together under hostile political control, then that would be a great threat to British security. Britain is not so much stronger than the European countries that she could afford to just, you know, wash her hands of what goes on there. As a matter of fact, Germany is a stronger country by the eve of World War I than Britain was. And so the British, thanks to the English Channel, thanks to the fact that they're an island, they don't have to immerse themselves in balance of power considerations to anything like the extent that France does. But they're not so strong and so far removed from Europe that they could be as ideological and immune to power political thinking as the Americans were. So they're halfway in between, by and large. And those are the kind of points between which the needle gyrates in terms of British thinking about international affairs. Are we in or are we out? Well, we're kind of half in. Okay? So you can't say, oh, well, the French political culture is so much more sophisticated than the American political culture. If it is, it's not an accident. It has a geopolitical taproot. So what is Clemenceau's view? The traditional view that you find in the textbooks is that he took a very hard line toward Germany, and there's evidence for that. But that's not the heart of his thinking. What is the heart of his thinking? Well, Wilson had laid out his peace program in the 14-point speech and in subsequent speeches. And when you read the 14-point speech, note that he's not calling for a peace of reconciliation with Germany. Just laying out the principles without a view to whether they would result in a more or less stable system in power political terms. Lloyd George, in January 1918, had also laid out a peace program similar to Wilson's. And Clemenceau was under pressure to present France's views. And he won't do it. He says he won't do it. And he gives this, I think, really extraordinary speech in the French Chamber of Deputies on shortly after the armistice. This is December 29th, 1918. And I remember just reading the speech and just kind of being bowled over by it. I thought it was like right out of Thucydides. And he takes issue with the whole, with the basic premises of the Anglo-Saxon liberal philosophy. He says, well, they think you could lay out these principles And then you'll have a peace, and because these principles reflect, you know, the basic moral sentiments of all humanity, everyone is going to accept it. He says, but it's not that simple. The world has not been established by divine decree. The kind of borders we have, the political relations we have, they're the product of these, you know, historical processes that have unfolded over centuries, processes in which force played the central role. Not right and wrong, but who's strong and who's weak. And in such circumstances, you're not going to have clear-cut moral principles. You know, every country is going to have its own perspective on what's right or wrong. And those differences mean that international conflict is not going to vanish if you base a peace on what you think are the right moral principles. You know, the security threat is going to continue for that reason. It's built into the basic structure of the system. And that being the case, you have to worry about your security. And how can you achieve your security? And it's, and essentially, in Clemenceau's view, there were three approaches. One approach was, the hardline approach, crushing Germany. Putting all these limits on German power, occupying German territory, maybe even tearing up Germany. To a certain extent, that was one string in its bow. But it was not the only or even the main string. Because there were these two other approaches. It's like, we can't keep Germany down forever, maybe. But if we maintain the wartime alliance of the three Western democracies and we keep British and French troops, on our border with Germany, that would provide for our security, because the three Western democracies, if they stay together as a bloc, they're more than a match for Germany. And if we hold together, we can pursue a relatively moderate policy vis-a-vis Germany, because even if Germany recovers all of her power, the Western democracies are stronger, right? And then there's this whole notion of, but if Britain and France don't go along with this, then maybe we should try and seek an accommodation with the Germans on a purely continental system where France and Germany can't come together as a counterweight to Britain and America. And he actually thinks along those lines as well. He wants all three possibilities, right? His heart is really on the maintenance of the wartime coalition, and he makes that clear in that speech, but he says, I am not going to lay out a precise peace program because I'm going to have to compromise with Britain and America in order to maintain this coalition. I don't want to tie my hands by making precise commitments right now. Yeah? The third policy is accommodation with Germany. Let's get together with the Germans. Let's form a bloc with the Germans. It's basically the policy that France pursued after World War II. The policy of the Schuman Plan and of building the European Economic Community, building the European Union. The Europeans should, the continental West Europeans should get together. And they get together and form a political bloc that's strong enough to stand up to the rest of the world, and in particular to the Americans on their own. Right, that stuff that you see after World War II, it has its taproot well back in 1919. All right, so Clemenceau, who's the most realist of the three, he's willing to kind of do all kinds of different things and feel his way toward a solution. What happens? Well, we're going to get at that by looking at these issues on a more detailed way, issue by issue basis, and that's going to be the lecture next time. Okay, thanks.